Thanks very much. Good afternoon, everyone. So I want to thank the organizers for the opportunity to come and speak to you today. So I found it interesting to put this presentation together, and so I hope you sort of find it interesting as well and you sort of think about what happened in the past. I think it's often, you know, critical to know what happened in the past to sort of help us know where we should go in the future. So this is a map of the agricultural areas in Canada, and I'm going to be speaking about the Canadian prairies this afternoon. So that's in the provinces of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba there, and that's a big block of land, and that represents about 80% of our crops or our cropland in Canada. And you'll see we're in the Great White North here, so 49 degrees latitude, and this would be 60 degrees latitude up here. So it obviously makes some differences in terms of crop production. This is a map of our soils in this region. We sort of talk about a big block of land, but obviously there's big variation in soils and climates across that region. But generally we have very good productive soils. A lot of them developed under grassland. It was mentioned in one of the previous talks. So in our brown soil zone, we would have 2 to 3% organic matter. In our black soil zone, we would have 7 to 10% organic matter. So productive soils, but our limitations are short growing season, 100 to 130 frost-free days, and the moisture is also limiting for us. Although we've been in a wetter cycle the last few years, but still we are a semi-arid area. So I'm going to talk now a little bit about the history of settlement in this region, and I'm going to talk quite a bit about tillage to begin with, and development of no-till, and eventually I will sort of get back to crop diversification and crop intensification. So, in terms of European settlers moving into this region, it's largely in the last 125 years, which is not that much different than much of the Western U.S. Transcontinental Railroad was let me get this pointer out of the road. Get that out of the road there. So, Transcontinental Railroad was completed in 1886, and so that opened the area up for people to move in there. And settlers came in, and the first crops they grew were small grain cereals, wheat, barley, and oats. They knew how to grow those crops. That was a big part of it, but those crops are reasonably drought tolerant compared to some other crops, and so they were suitable for that region at that time. And then the practice of summer fallow was developed in many different regions at the same time as it would have been happening here in the U.S., and that became a very common practice of a crop fallow sort of rotation, and a very heavy reliance on tillage. And so if we look at some of the advantages and disadvantages of fallow, I think in the early days there certainly were advantages in terms of saving soil moisture for this next crop, and it was a very good way of managing weeds as well. But over time, the disadvantages became very evident, and they started to outweigh any advantages. And so the most obvious ones being soil erosion, decreased organic matter, and increased salinity over time. So we sort of got through a few decades of pretty good crop production, although scientists were warning before that time that we were going down a path that really was probably not sustainable. We didn't really hit the wall, I guess, until the dirty 30s came along. And it really highlighted that the cropping practices at that time were not sustainable. Many farms were abandoned. People just walked away from their land. And we had at least 1 million hectares of land that was deserted land. And, you know, we sort of had soil movement. We had these mini sand dunes and everything else. And so the government stepped in some of that, in some of those areas, and developed a community pasture system. So what they did is they reseeded that area to perennial forages, and they managed that land, and then they allowed the farmers and ranchers to graze their cattle on that land for a fee. And those community pastures are still in existence today. So they've been around 75, 80 years, and it was a way, and that was the best land use of some of that, those poor soils, was not to grow a crop, but actually to put them back into pastures. So here's some pictures of what our wind erosion events look like. You can see it can be serious in some cases. These pictures are not the 30s. These pictures are the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. So this was still occurring in much more recent times. And so it's pretty obvious, you know, that something has to happen. Things have to change in the worst areas. And this was worse on the southern Canadian prairies, which is our drier region. So the southern parts of Alberta, southern parts of Saskatchewan. But rethinking tillage was very difficult. So we've been using tillage for centuries to control weeds, to prepare a seedbed, and that's really all the farmers knew at that time. And so it was a big step for them to sort of move into something else. And let's say it was one of the main ways of controlling weeds. So like I say, a big step. Just want you to note here on the far corner there, that's a picture of myself on my very first research plot tractor. So I was very proudly driving that around. So I've been around a while. So certain developments came in tillage. You know, I'm going to end up talking about no-till, but the story for a long time in between was some type of reduced tillage. And so this is a picture of a noble blade. How many people in the room know a noble blade? Know what we're talking about, whatever, okay. Did you know it was developed in Lethbridge, Alberta? Few people know that. So, okay, so Charles Noble, a farmer, developed it in the late 1930s. Comment was made before that a lot of good inventions come from farmers, not from ag machinery. We have the same story. All of our no-till seed drills were developed by farmers in the 70s and 80s, not by farm machinery companies. So here's another example. And, you know, and he had some, it was his idea, he did the work, he did sort of work with the scientists at the Lethbridge Research Station, fine-tuned it, tested it, whatever, and ended up developing it and, you know, and manufactured it. So it was one of the first good examples of non-eversion tillage. And so this is a picture of what that might look like. Where the shanks are here, you'll see that there's some soil disturbance, but otherwise you see that it maintains the crop residues on the soil surface, right? And so that reduces the speed of the wind and wind erosion. So it was a major advance, and it was used on fallow land, primarily during that fallow year, and worked quite well. But still, if you were to use that instrument, piece of equipment 3, 4, 5 times, you still were in a situation of not having a lot of residue on the soil surface. And then sort of development in 1980s was to use a combination of herbicides and tillage to control our weeds on fallow. And so this particular one, this is my plot in Lethbridge here. It received a fall 2,4-D treatment for winter annual weeds. We came in the spring, which would be April or early May, with a spring rustler, and then we came in with a noble blade, and then we might come in one more time with a noble blade. But it was sort of a combination of trying to maintain residues, but trying to make it economical for farmers at the same time. But variations of that that treatment I show you right there became the standard treatment on about 25 million acres in Western Canada. Other practices were developed. Strip cropping, probably many in the room are familiar with that as well. It was certainly widely used in our area to reduce wind erosion. And then other equipment like a sweep plow, the disker, the rod weeder all came in. And, you know, and really we have not used a moldboard plow since probably the 20s or the 30s. So, you know, we haven't been there for a long, long time. So some type of reduced tillage. But in terms of crops, pretty much cereals. Not much in terms of diversification here in terms of other crops. There would have been some flax growing. My family farm, we always had flax in our rotation. There would have been some mustard been growing. But we were still pretty much cereals, small grain cereals at that time. So now we move along to the development of no-till. We knew we had to get there, but there was a lot of problems to solve. Probably took about 2 to 3 decades of research to get to solving the problem and then actually having it economical enough for producers to use. So the early research was in the 60s, maybe even in the 50s in some regions. Earliest farmers adopted it in our region in the late 70s, but we didn't get widespread adoption until the mid-1990s, so maybe just 20 years ago. But when it happened, it really revolutionized crop production in our region, and I'll show you some examples of that. So, and this is a picture of our no-till plot. This is the Lethbridge Research Station again. So we have 48 continuous years of no-till, and that's one of the older sites anywhere in the world. So where are we now? 75% of our crops are direct seeded. Soil erosion has been greatly reduced. Standing crop stubble facilitates greater snow trapping, so this was sort of these unattended consequences in a good way. So before, a lot of our snow would blow into the fence lines, would blow into the ditches, would blow into the trees, and really wasn't much of much use to us. But it represents a fair bit of our precipitation during the year. So if we can get an extra 2 or 3 inches of moisture from that effect, and then we're not cultivating the soil in the spring to plant our crops, so we're not drying out our soils, it all adds up to an extra 2, 3, 4 inches. And it maybe doesn't sound like a lot, but we can go through 18 months of fallow and only save 2, 3, 4 inches of moisture. And so it was sort of mind-boggling that how efficient it could be compared to something. The fallow really wasn't very efficient in our system. So what's happened in terms of fallow? A 90% reduction in our fallow acreage. So that's a huge success story for us. And now we grow crops that require more soil water, and I'll give some examples of that. So at the same time, as this no-till story was being researched and being adopted and being developed, there was a lot of effort put into the development of alternative crops in our system. And so that was the federal government was doing the work, the provincial governments were doing the work, the universities were doing the work, and really looking at what would grow in our region. So one of the things I said earlier is our short growing season. So lots of crops that we looked at, they just do not mature in time before we get a killing frost, which might be the middle of September. So there was work in there. There was work on water requirement, looking at yield. Once some good potential crops were identified, then the plant breeders got to work and you know, really selected for early maturity and drought tolerance and all the good things. And so really our first, what I would say, the first really big movement into crop diversification happened in the 1970s with canola. We got the first double zero, low uric acid, low glucosinolates. That's the first story anywhere in the world. You know that story already. And that was adopted in the black soil zone where they had higher rainfall amounts to be able to grow a canola crop that requires more moisture than a cereal crop does. And then field pea and lentil came along in the 1980s. But that was still restricted pretty much to the black soil zone. In the brown and the dark brown soil zone, we still said we don't have enough moisture, or we don't have enough reliable moisture from year to year to grow those crops. And farming is about risk management, so we might have good years, but we might have bad years. And it really wasn't until we adopted no-till in a big way that producers then realized that we could probably move in that direction. So where are we now? Well, there's been a huge change. This is showing crop production changes from 1995. I picked that year because that's probably where we got to that range of 60, 70, 75% no-till until 2013 statistics. And what you'll see is there's been a general decrease in cereals, but we have a big increase in oil seeds and some of our pulse crops. And so canola is a big winner for us, 140% increase. I mean, that's really 2.5 times the amount of canola. And then big increases in field pea and lentil, and to a certain extent dry beans there as well. So lots more different crops being grown in our rotations. And recently we have areas of soybean, corn, faba bean, hemp, camelina, and carinata all being grown in this region as well. So there's a lot of crop diversity compared to just 20 years ago, even 25 years ago. And I just want to stress again, we now have 12 million acres of land that used to be fallow that now grows a crop every year. So that's a huge, huge difference in terms of the intensification of our cropping system. Instead of that land degrading, it's at least holding its own or improving. So big, big changes. Soil quality, certainly when we adopted no-till, our losses in organic carbon have stabilized, have been abated. We sometimes see some small increases that was mentioned before. These are very, very slow and small increases in organic matter that can happen, but they're largely due to the elimination of fallow. That's number one, by hands down, is just getting rid of fallow. And then secondly would be no-till practices, improve that. And then here's some data on soil microbial biomass. This is some of work of Newton Lepuy, one of our scientists with Agriculture Canada in Beaver Lodge and now in Lethbridge. But what we're showing here is that there's greater soil microbial biomass under zero till than conventional till, zero till being the darker blue line there. So, and it's also affected by rotation, and so it would be higher with legume crops, the RC being red clover and the FP being field pea. So that's another sort of advantage we found, is the no-till is good, but by having legume crops in our rotations, it's really been good for our soil microbial populations. And of course, that's very good for nutrient cycling and also can be useful in terms of suppressing soil-borne diseases as well. Now, I'm a weed scientist, so I have to say a couple of words about weeds. You know, certainly in the early days, you know, there was a lot of fear that we wouldn't be able to manage weeds at all. If we didn't use tillage, how were we ever going to control weeds? The story is it's not as bad as what some people thought it would be. And some of the reasons are we have greater weed seed mortality when they're left on the soil surface, especially in our climate, I think, with our cold winters that we have. Crop residues suppress germination. We have healthier and more competitive crops to compete with our weeds. And just this greater crop rotational diversity helps keeps weeds in balance, or helps keep weeds in check. And I'll give you an example of that as well. So now I want to sort of move on and talk about, integrated crop management practices. And they're important from a pest management point of view, but they're important from a profit point of view in farmers making money. And, you know, and farmers are only going to adopt these systems if they're profitable. That's what we all need to remember. They have to make money doing these things. So we have to make them profitable for them to grow them, but we have to make them profitable enough that they'll keep growing them and not just sort of revert growing back to wheat as soon as our price goes up to $10 a bushel of wheat, we're all going to rush back and grow wheat. Well, we don't want that to happen. So some of the things that have been adopted, certainly we have much more diverse crop rotations than we had 25 years ago. Higher crop seeding rates of our cereals, because we now have more soil moisture, we're not worrying about that hang-off effect that we used to talk about. We've doubled or tripled the seeding rates of our cereals. We get higher crop yields because of that, and that's why farmers do it, but they're also much more competitive with weeds, and so that's good from a weeds point of view. Strategic fertilizer use, I'll show you an example here, but most of our fertilizer now is subsurface banded, and the majority of it would be applied in the spring, where we used to apply quite a bit of it in the fall, actually. Early in-crop herbicide application is now the standard application, and I'll mention a little bit about cover crops. I think there's huge potential. We struggle with making them work in our system, but I do think there's potential there. Certainly our organic farmers use them all the time, conventional farmers not so much. I have to just talk about crop rotation, and it's really probably one of the key ways that we can manage weeds, diseases, or insects, and I think it's important from soil quality. And really, I really think you cannot have sustainable agricultural systems unless you have crop rotation. I feel very, very strongly about that. And this is just one example with the weeds. This is downy brome and winter wheat. So, many of the winter wheat's the crop, and a big crop in the U.S. here. But you have a winter annual weed in a winter annual crop. It's well adapted to that system. And you see that the numbers increase quite dramatically. But if you just simply go to a two-year rotation of growing winter wheat with a spring crop, in this case being spring canola, you can keep those densities down at relatively low numbers. And that similar story sort of happens in diseases and insects in many cases. This is some work in terms of fertilizer. Okay. Farmers started moving towards placing their fertilizer below the soil, and concentrating it in bands to have greater to reduce their losses and increase the efficiency, but it can have quite a dramatic effect on wheat populations as well. So on the left-hand side here, we have a surface broadcast nitrogen 4 years in a row. This is wild mustard in spring wheat. And this weed responds very highly to the fertilizer and does very well in this case. And on the right-hand side, we have subsurface banded nitrogen 4 years in a row. And so that's the only differences between those. There's no herbicide in here, so it's a worst-case scenario. But what's happening here is in a no-till system, most of our weed seeds are on the surface. We put our fertilizer down below the soil surface. We're just trying to get preferential access to the crop and away from the weeds. And if you do this any one given year, you may or may not see any difference at all. But if you do it for several years in a row, you can have a huge effect. Cover crops, green manure crops, we know... You know, there's a lot of pluses, but as I said before, organic farmers are using them, or conventional farmers are not using them in most cases. But I'm going to give you one example of where they are a bit, and this is actually on irrigated land, so doesn't really fit into the dryland system a bit, but I think a few dryland guys will look at this as well. But we have an irrigated area where they grow potatoes, sugar beets, and dry bean in rotation, and none of those crops really give enough residue on the soil surface to protect the land from soil erosion. So there's a big problem here. So what we did in our research is we plant a winter rye crop in September. We allow it to grow over the winter. It regrows, goes dormant in the winter, regrows in early April. We kill it with glyphosate in the middle of May. And then we spray it one day and we plant it into it the very next day. It's easier to seed into it when the crop is standing before it starts collapsing. You get less tangling, less drag effect of the seeding. And seeded dry beans into that. And here you can see that we have a narrow row beans. These are 9-inch row beans merging nicely through that residue. We've protected the land from erosion. We're suppressing some weeds. We've increased water infiltration, and it works quite well, and there are several producers that are doing that in our region. I want to talk a little bit more about integrated crop management systems. You know, several researchers have found that you know, when we're talking about agronomic practices, you have to have several of them together to have a meaningful effect. And in terms of weed management, Randy Anderson was one of the first people to show that you needed a minimum of 3 good cultural weed control practices. So we might be talking about seeding rate, we might talk about row spacing, we might be talking about different things like that, fertilizer. And so you need to get several of them together to have a meaningful effect, but really, actually, maybe even more important is you have to do those things for multiple years in a row to have an effect. So I'll give you a couple examples here. The first one is in canola. We had a factorial arrangement of 3 agronomic practices. We looked at a hybrid or open pollinated cultivar. We had 3 seeding rates, and then we applied our herbicide at the 2-leaf, the 4-leaf, or the 6-leaf stage of canola. And I'm going to jump right to the yield data here. So this is 6 site years of data at Lethbridge and Lacombe. So in our traditional system, we would have had an open pollinated canola. We would have went with a low seeding rate of 100 seeds per square meter. And we would have waited for all of our weeds to emerge before we applied our herbicide. And that would be our yield. If we do a few things differently, well, we grow a hybrid canola, so it's a little bit unfair here. It's a higher yielding potential. But still, a big part of that was increasing the seeding rate to 150 or 200 seeds per square meter, and then applying our herbicide much earlier to control a big flush of weeds before they had a chance to actually cause major reductions in the yield. And the differences here are 41% increase in yield by just doing those things together. And when farmers see these numbers, it's very exciting for them, and they adopt those systems rather quickly when they do that. So I want to show that it's good in canola and driving that whole system, but like as I said before, we want them to keep growing these alternative crops, so it's important that they are profitable. And I'll show one here, one more example, just talking sort of about the power of multi-year practices and how effective they can be. So here's another factorial experiment. We have a rotation. Well, we have continuous barley for 5 years in a row, or we have a rotation, which is barley, canola, barley, peas, and then we come back to barley. We have two cultivars, we have two different seeding rates, and we have three rates to the herbicide. And the most important thing is we applied these treatments on top of each other for 5 years in a row. So this is what we're looking at. In the fifth year, I'm going to show you some data, 5 years of barley versus 5 years of a rotation. And you'll see that if we go from a short cultivar to a tall cultivar, it's going to be more competitive with weeds. We could reduce the biomass of wild oak by twofold. If we increased our seeding rate, we could reduce it by threefold. If we put both of those factors together, it was eightfold, so that's what I'm talking about before. It's a little bit more than just additive in some cases. But the real power here was crop rotation. If we threw in the third factor, being in this case being crop rotation, it was a 70% reduction in wild oak populations. And what we hope is that that pays off in terms of yield, and in this case it does. So where we have crop rotation, we have higher yields, and certainly when we increase the seeding rate of the crop, we had higher yields as well. So it pays for itself. In that case, probably the semi-dwarf cultivar had a higher harvest index and was a better cultivar to grow. But you sort of get the idea of trying to include multiple things together to come up with more sustainable cropping practices. So this is my last slide here, just sort of moving forward. And in our research, we're certainly going to try and continue to develop and foster adoption of more sustainable agricultural systems. And that's along the lines of addressing soil losses. I mean, we're not home free in terms of erosion and soil losses. They still happen from time to time. Improve water use efficiency, adopt integrated pest management and integrated crop management systems where we can. Climate change is going to affect all of us. I don't think we know how yet. And I don't think that we can stop climate change. So I'm more about sort of adopting and adapting and mitigating as we move forward. And obviously incorporate new technologies when and where appropriate. So I'll end it there, and I thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Pat?
Yeah. Did you ever run into any problems with dry season when you were seeding into that standing rye, or was it really
not going to
seed?
The question was in the example of the fall rye and we were seeding into it. No, we seem to have enough moisture all years. We did that for 4 years in a row, and so it worked out well. It is an irrigated area, but it wouldn't have been pre-irrigated before that. So we were okay. Yeah. I think dry beans, you can seed a little bit deeper into the soil too, so that helps a bit. Yes?
Do you see herbicide resistance problems causing any threat to the system in the developing product?
Yeah, so the question is, do I see the herbicide resistance issue being a potential problem for our system? And, I think the answer is yes. So we do have herbicide resistance, and it is a concern, and it's getting worse every year. And I guess we've sort of taken tillage out as weed management in a lot of cases, but again, I go back to the power of some of these crop production practices helping address that in terms of combining several agronomic practices together to reduce our weed populations. But weed resistance is and will be a concern going forward. Any other questions? Yes?
Do you see the corn belt shifting your way in the future with climate change? I know in Ontario we're all talking about you guys getting corn and soybeans.
And we're going to take it away from you. Yeah, the question is, do I see more corn and soybean grown in our region? And the answer is yes. I mean, partly that's a plant breeding effort that has selected for genotypes that will mature in a shorter growing season. And part of it is just a warming climate as well. So already soybeans have moved from North Dakota into southern Manitoba. And I think we're well over 1 million acres of soybean in Manitoba, and they're being played around with by farmers in Saskatchewan, Alberta. And certainly Pioneer and Monsanto have big aspirations for 6 to 8 million acres of corn in the next 6 or 7 years. So whether that happens or not. But some of that will happen.
So do you have a plan to maintain rotation diversity?
I think if it's done right, it actually just increases rotational diversity. So we have more crops that are viable crops, that are profitable crops, that farmers can choose among them, as long as they don't revert into some type of... There's always a danger of sort of reverting into a monoculture system. And even in recent years, it's changing maybe a little bit this year, but say 3 years ago, a lot of farmers grew wheat, canola, because the prices jumped up a lot in wheat, and canola is almost always a higher price, but they went from a 3 or 4 year crop rotation down to a 2 year crop rotation in some cases, which is not where we want to go. Okay, break time, I guess. Thanks very much.
Yep.